Mr. Lazenby, reel 5.
Now, did you have to make any special preparations of the Emperor to receive these Russian evacuees?
Yes, we only took one load on the ship itself, and we packed a lot of them in. We roped off a little area forward for the men and an area aft for the officers to come on deck, but the remainder of the deck was crammed with these people. We made latrines for them, which were just a long plank with holes in it over buckets and a screen round them, one each side. When we got to Mudros, we had to clean these things out, and it was an awful mess. I mean, 4 days using them.
What sort of condition did the refugees seem to be in?
Oh, they were in an awful condition, really. I guess some of them must have marched for miles. They were worn out, their boots were worn through, they were muddy, up to the hips in mud, some of them. But women as well, carrying rifles, bandoliers on, no possessions, nothing with them. Looked as though they'd been running from something.
Were you able to talk to any of them?
No, I couldn't speak Russian. Half a minute.
Now, during the evacuation, were you involved in any offensive action?
Only once. We'd loaded up with refugees, and we were ready to sail when the shore batteries opened up on us. They just riddled one funnel with a bit of shrapnel, but we replied with full calibre 13-inch guns. And a terrific noise from a 13.5 going off, and these poor people on the forecastle were just underneath the muzzles of the guns. It must have almost split their eardrums. That's the only action we had. Whether we hit anything, I don't know.
And you took these refugees to Mudros. What were your activities on Mudros?
Mudros, we built a refugee camp with stuff we'd brought up from Malta. Tents, bedding, blankets, cooking utensils, and all that sort of stuff. We made a subsequent trip to Malta for more stuff, but we built this great camp at Mudros for them.
Did you or any of your messmates have any particular views about the operations against the Red Russians?
I didn't, because I didn't know what it was all about. And I don't know whether any of my messmates did either. I don't think we did. We didn't realise what was going on.
You knew that we weren't at war with Russia. I wondered if that gave you pause for thought.
No, we knew that there was a revolution going on. We knew that we'd been asked to evacuate these people from danger. But apart from that, I don't think the political implications made any impact on us at all.
You also went to Constantinople while you were on the Emperor of India. What was the purpose of that visit?
Well, at that time, Constantinople was under Allied control after the war. And it wasn't merely under British control, because there was an American warship there, a big French warship there, and always a British warship. There was a Portuguese warship, among others. And the place was under Allied control.
What did the conditions in the city seem to be like when you were there?
They were pretty grim. The place was overcrowded with Russian refugees. We always imagined that every girl was a white Russian princess, you know, who'd come down and sold all the jewellery to escape. But when we landed, we had to have sidearms on, belt and bayonet in the case of us people, and officers and petty officers with revolvers on. And we were not allowed to go in about alone. We had to go in groups of at least two, but probably four.
How had things in Constantinople seemed to settle down after the war? Was there much sort of privation and hardship?
Oh, yes, there was a lot of hardship then.
Could you give me some examples?
Well, I think soap must have been very hard to come by, chocolate, tobacco and cigarettes, because we could get almost anything we wanted for chocolate and cigarettes, and soap especially. Swap almost anything for it.
Well, now, while you were on the Emperor of India, you were part of the Mediterranean station and spent a lot of time in Malta. I'm very interested in life in Malta itself. to start off with, I wonder, was the behaviour of British seamen in foreign ports generally any different from behaviour in home ports?
I think so. I think so, because they would have more freedom. They wouldn't be hampered by home ties or anything like that, and the temptations were much greater. I mean, there was nothing laid on for them, apart from the pubs and that sort of thing. There was the opera house, but what sailor wanted to go to an opera house? I thought about all they had was the pubs, prostitutes.
Yeah, yes, well, wasn't there an expression that the seamen applied to Malta? It was a place.
An expression that what? Oh, I know what you mean, yeah. Oh, yes, we called Malta the place of the three P's, pubs, priests and prostitutes.
As regards the pubs and the prostitutes, how did Malta compare, say, with Chatham?
Oh, they were much more prolific. A lot more pubs and a lot more prostitutes. There were a lot of, not Maltese girls, you know, there were a lot of English girls out there, prostitutes. Used to have been dragged out there for dancing and hostesses and that sort of thing, we'd call them nowadays. But they'd obviously come out there to earn a living as what they thought would be actresses or hostesses or something, and no other outlet for them except prostitution. They used to serve in the bars.
After quite long trips, what was the first thing that you would aim to do when you got into Malta? Was there something that you missed in particular that you'd try and take advantage of when you were in port?
No, because I didn't drink. It didn't bother me. Mm-hmm. But I think that most of the lads, all we wanted to do was to get ashore and get a drink. The only drink you got aboard the ship was your tot of rum.
How was shore leave arranged when you were in Malta?
It was arranged alternatively. You're in two watches, port and starboard watches, and you're allowed, the men were allowed from 4:30 to 7:30 in the morning. It's all night leave. Petty officers and chiefs till a little later in the morning. Boys, of course, weren't allowed all night leave. You could get ashore in the evening, but you weren't allowed to stay ashore all night.
Mm-hmm. You've mentioned that the sort of different type of behaviour of British seamen in Malta as compared with home. I wonder, was there much more crime as a result? And what arrangements were made to sort of deal with it?
Well, there was a lot more leave breaking. There was a lot more drunkenness. And there was a lot more attempts to smuggle beer into the ship, which was frowned upon. The punishments were usually, for bringing beer aboard the ship, would be maybe 3 days in the cells. For breaking your leave, you were punished by a scale of deprivation of pay and leave. If you were an hour over your leave, you'd lose a day's pay and a day's leave, and that sort of thing.
What kind of uses were made of Maltese civilians by the Navy at that time?
Oh, quite a lot. Malta depended heavily on the British Navy. All the dockyard employees, well, I'd say all, most of them, all the, except the executives and the probably the high-ups, were all Maltese dockyard mates, we used to call them. And they also did all sorts of things on the ship. We had a Maltese canteen manager, we had Maltese cooks for the officers. The Maltese used to have a contract for collecting all the swill from the ship, all the refuse.
What do you mean, a contract?
Well, they used to pay for the privilege of collecting all the food refuse. You weren't allowed to empty anything down the chute in Malta, otherwise you'd silt up the harbour. They used to say that half the ships were aground on tins, but they weren't. You weren't allowed to empty them. And then the Maltese used to collect everything. You went to throw it down the chute, you couldn't do it. But they had a strainer at the top and they used to throw all the spare food down. The liquids would strained off and went into the sea, but all the solid stuff they kept and they put it into big drums, like 40-gallon oil drums. And they'd take it ashore, and you could see them on the front queuing up to buy the stuff for food. It was all our refuse.
Was there much of a trade plied between Maltese boatmen and the ships?
No, not not as bumboats. They didn't sell us anything, but they were employed by the ship to take us ashore, bring us back again. When we went ashore, the dicers, they were called, dicers we used to call them, they'd line up and take us ashore. And when we wanted to come back, we'd just hail one like you'd hail a taxi and bring us back. And some of the dicers attached themselves to a ship and they had the ship's name on, you see. They were applying for HMS Emperor of India or a Benbow. They were some of the Benbow's dicers and they wouldn't look at anything else. And they were the only ones who were allowed to queue up at the gangway to take you ashore, you see.
How do you spell dicers?
D-G-H-A-I-S-A, dicer. What the plural is, I don't know. We used to call them dicers. Yes.
Did you ever get it? Did you ever find any women taken aboard ship?
Not to stay aboard, but there were. We often had dances, and some of the officers had their wives out there, and there were British residents who had their ladies and friends out there.
I was thinking of Maltese ladies of easy leisure.
Oh no, 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 no! You couldn't get them aboard.
Now, regattas, I know, played a very important part in the sort of sporting and recreational life of the ships. In preparation for those regattas, how much time was spent on training for them?
Oh, quite a long time. They probably started training for one regatta soon after the other had finished. Because when the fleet was together, the regatta was an annual event. And they would start not only training the crews physically, with physical training, weightlifting and that sort of thing, but also preparing the boats.
Mm. As regards the crews, how were the crews to represent the ships selected?
I think they were asked for volunteers. In the first place, you'd ask for volunteers for boats' crews and then pick out the best. The officers would pick out the fittest men or... you probably have a few runs in the boat, see who was the best oarsman.
And what sort of training of the crews took place?
They gave them as much practical training as they could in the boats themselves. When in the evenings, they'd often pipe away racing boats' crew to go and practice. But of course, when we're at sea, they couldn't do the practice very well, and so they used to have a rope going through a pulley with a big weight on it, and the looms of the oars attached to that, and they'd pull up and pull this weight up as they pulled, and as they recovered, you see, they'd drop the weight onto a mat, probably a 500 weight sinker or a couple of them, just to keep them going.
Now, you told me that the preparation of the boats was pretty meticulous. Could you go into a bit of detail about that?
There were strict rules about it. You were not allowed to interfere with the structure of the boat at all. You could strip the paint off it. You could clean the bottom of the boat, sandpaper it down, but you were not allowed to blacklead it, which was a favourite dodge. But you could repaint it. It was always repainted again. You could smooth it down as much as you like, but you were not allowed to put any polish on it, you know, any blacklead or that sort of thing. Otherwise, when a boat was racing, they strip everything out of it, all that they could take out, anchors and water barricades and all the gratings out of the bottom, things like that, make it as light as it could.
How many different classes of boats were raced?
Every class of boat that we had on a ship, no, the battleship in those days carried a pinnace, which was a 42-foot long one, and a launch, which was exactly the same. One was called a pinnace and one was called a launch. But usually the launch had a motor in it, and the pinnace was a sailing pinnace. But so they used the pinnace, and we probably had three cutters, 30-foot cutters, 12 oars, two whalers, they carried seven oars, three one side, four the other. And then there were the gig and the galley. And
what were
the skiffs. The gig and the galley, they were single bank boats like the whalers, but they were very long and thin, very long and very shallow, very small beam. And they were much faster. They were really the captain's boats. The captain had a gig in those days. And instead of going ashore in one of the picket boats or even the barge, on a ceremonial occasion, he'd go on his gig. And he had his gig's crew, and they had special clothes on that he used to provide for them, you know, cloth suits instead of serge suits. And the gig was the best kept boat in the ship. Mm-hmm. Everything was smashing about that. And usually painted black, but everything inside it scrubbed white.
So there was the gig, and what others
the did? Galley.
The galley.
They were exactly the same, mm-hmm. but one was always called a gig. Because that was the captain's own special boat and his own special crew. You see, the captain of a ship, he not only had, he didn't have a messenger like the first lieutenant or the commander, he had a coxswain, a petty officer, who was like his batman. And he was called the captain's coxswain. And when the captain went in his gig, his coxswain steered the gig. And the captain's gig's crew did not, well, they were the only people who ever pulled the gig when the captain was in.
So that's the gig and the galley. Any others that were raised?
Two skiffs.
What were they?
13-foot skiffs, four oars, but they're usually two oars. They're usually one-man skiff, you know, for these races.